Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Midpoint. My guest today is Edith Bowman, a woman who's been on our screens and airwaves for over 20 years, extolling a passion for music and the arts with a down-to-earth and engaging style, which for me seems to cut through some of the nonsense that so often makes those on the periphery of the arts feel that they're not for them. She's presented everything from MTV, Rise, Top of the Pops, and this year the BAFTAs on telly, to shows on radio, on Capital FM, Radio 1 and Radio 5 Live. And then, of course, there are the big live shows and festivals, which she seemingly does with ease. She's just recently moved herself and her two boys with her rock star husband Tom Smith of the band The Editors to the countryside and seems to be living a very nice version of the good life. Solgar are on board again today sponsoring, and Solgar 7 is the next generation alternative after glucosamine to support mobility, flexibility and a range of motion in sensitive joints. Solgar 7 can help to get you back on track to all the activities you enjoy with improvement shown in just 7 days. So thank you, Solgar, for supporting it. Okay, let's go chat to Edith. Edith, how do I find you? How's life?
Do you know what? All right, to be honest. Just ticking along, you know, doing what I'm supposed to be doing. But good, you know, in a really nice place. We moved out of London about 2 months before the first lockdown, so it was good timing on our part. We're back to where Tom grew up, so it's a familiar part of the world. But out in Gloucestershire.
Right. And how have you personally taken to kind of being an English country bumpkin?
I love it, you know. It's kind of weird. I always had this kind of negative reflex about going back, you know, in terms of, for me personally, of going back to my little fishing village in Scotland, because I kind of escaped is kind of how, almost how I describe it, and that I knew, my mum will even kind of confirm us that she knew before I did that I was going to be kind of getting out of Dodge sort of thing and going and exploring. And weirdly, I appreciate and enjoy it. It's such a wonderful place to go back to. In fact, we're going back next week for a week with the kids. But I needed to kind of spread my wings and look for other places to settle. And I spent 20 years in London and I loved it. But what I needed to do, and one of the reasons for this move, was to try and separate work and home a little bit more, mm-hmm. which was good for 2 months. And then lockdown happened. And then you joined me in my home studio. So, you know, it was like, now it's a case of eat your dinner. I've just got to go upstairs and do an interview. And so it's had a slightly kind of, you know, negative reaction to what we originally planned sort of thing. But I absolutely love it. And it encourages me to look after myself a bit more, I think, as well. I've got to an age where I appreciate exercise, appreciate time.
And do you think you've got more time living where you're living then? Because of that, not being on top of the shop almost in London.
I think what I've done is I've managed to just slow things down a bit. And it's so funny because I'm in town at least 2 days a week anyway. And even when I jump on the train, the first thing I kind of feel is almost like things revving up. You know those flat escalators you get at airports that, I mean, yeah, they don't really get you there any faster.
No. I walk on those. I can't stand still on those.
But I kind of feel that weirdly, it's a bit like that going into London, that you're on one of those that's kind of, it's a faster pace. So I don't know, I just pay attention a bit more, I think.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? Because it's, you know, to make those kind of changes in the middle of our lives, in some ways it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? Because, like, you know, where I live, there's that conversation. When did you come out? When did you come out? You know?
Yeah.
And a lot of people did. But I guess it's natural, isn't it, that you can't keep going at that pace all the time, especially when you've got kids, because you will burn out, won't you, eventually, if you keep going at that pace. And your balance when you're 23 is not the same as it's going to be when you're 45, 46. But your husband's a bit younger than you, isn't he?
Yeah. He's my toy boy. And it's weird because he's almost an older soul in a way as well. Mm. It's quite interesting that he's, you know, considering what he does, you know, being the front man of a rock band, he's a very quiet and private and shy person. And so this is perfect for him, you know, in terms of just being able to kind of go at his own pace and see people when he wants to see people sort of thing. But I feel like I did it for the kids as well in a way, just to almost preserve their childhood a little bit. Mm. You know, Spike's 8 and Rudy's just turned 13. And I could just see the pace at which things are thrown at them.
How have they taken to it?
Yeah, they love it. And I think because we came to an area that was familiar with them, you know, their grandma and granddad are up the road. So we'd spend loads of time out here anyway. So they knew the skate park and they knew the leisure centre and things like that. So it wasn't like it was coming somewhere totally unknown. Mm. And they've dealt with it amazingly, actually. Probably better than I would have. The idea of changing schools, even thinking back on it, terrifies me. And my oldest did it twice in the space of 4 months because he just moved school in London. And then we...
But you had such a settled upbringing, didn't you? And, and you were in the same town pretty much your whole life until you came to London. I moved around all the time because of my dad's job being a footballer.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I changed schools about 8 times and countries and cities and, you know, and testament to my mum's kind of incredible attitude towards it. It never bothered me at all because she made it an adventure. But my kids are a bit more, you know, they had their first period of school in London. Then they came out to where we live now. And if I suggest anything adventurous, like when they were about 12, I said, why don't we go live in France for a year before you do your GCSEs? And honestly, you'd thought I'd said, why don't we all start mainlining heroin? I mean, they were literally kind of freaking out at this kind of prospect. And so I think it is interesting to kind of give your kids a bit of a jolt like that sometimes, actually.
Yeah, it's you know, it's interesting watching them make friends again and making new sets of friends. And, you know,
because the choices might be different. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And the environment's different. And, you know, Rudy's just started playing cricket for a little cricket club that his dad used to play for when he was a kid, which is so sweet.
Adorable.
And what I love with that is that there are kids from maybe 8 different schools that play on a train on a Monday night. And so his friendship group is kind of even, you know, is expanding in a way as well. And so, I don't know, there is a kind of romantic sort of Nancy Myers notion of moving out to the country. And there is part of it that's true, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's bits of it that are a bit more challenging, aren't there?
Yeah.
But, do you know, I've passed across a few times over the last 20 odd years, but not that often. But what I saw as a kind of interesting parallel was, if this is true, what I read about you, you're a year younger than me. And about, I think it was about 2009, it might have been, you had a bit of a wobbly time with Radio 1 when you kind of, you know, it read like you were a little bit unsure about where you were going at that point in your career. And I'd had a similar thing 2 years before that with ITV, where I was pretty much sidelined and kind of almost felt like I had to build my career again at that point. And we would have been similar ages when those things happened to us. And it's interesting kind of how you deal with that, in that I was like mid-30s, you know, kind of early to mid-30s. And how you dealt with it, obviously, it looks to me like you then decided almost, you know what, I'm going to do the stuff I really want to do. Because from then on, you seem to really get into the arts, the films, doing the kind of music you wanted to do. Tell me a little bit about that process.
Yeah, it's that thing, isn't it, where people are making decisions that are out of your control about your life that is terrifying. And the Radio 1 stuff was interesting because I'd had Rudy and I'd had conversations with my bosses about what my future was at Radio 1, and it felt like it was, you know, there was a future there in terms of where it was going, and there was suggestions on where that might lead to within the station and what the kind of, you know, ultimate kind of goal would be. And that was just pulled out from under me. That was kind of, I thought I was going in for a meeting to be kind of told that was the direction we were going eventually, because I've been waiting a while for it. And then it was the complete opposite in terms of...
So sideswiped you completely.
Absolutely. No warning, no kind of... and with the person that had kind of made these, not promises to me, but, you know...
Led you to believe that, yeah, absolutely, things were okay.
And so it's kind of like, well, and there was no real, it was a bit like, you know, like a breakup when you don't really know why the breakup's happened, where they can't give you a reason. It was a little bit like that because the figures were amazing. And I could only put it down to my age and the fact that I'd become I was a mum, and it wasn't cool, and it wasn't part of the image that Radio 1 wanted to present. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while. I was so upset. I mean, I cried in the meeting because I was, you know, I love what I do and I'm passionate about it. And I don't do things if I don't kind of believe in them, really. I mean, you know, then I felt like, and when I look back now, I was still on a path of kind of discovery as to what I wanted to do, really. But the opportunities I was given at Radio 1 were extraordinary, and it gave me kind of my foot in so many things that I've gone on to explore and delve deeper into. But it took me a long time to kind of get over that. And and to pick myself up from it, really, and find the confidence again, because it really knocked me for six.
Did you ever at that point think, okay, this isn't for me anymore, I can't handle this kind of rejection for no apparent, you know, when you've talked about being out of control, and that's the thing, I think, when you work really hard and you've worked hard on your career, and it's such a subjective kind of thing that somebody decides, you know, this is not for you now. Did you doubt you'd even stay in the business?
No, I never doubted. What I have this kind of, when someone says no to me or kind of...
not the right answer.
It's kind of almost a bit like it will make me fight harder in a way. I remember when I first started and I was getting work experience, I was trying to get work experience at what was Radio 4th in Edinburgh at the time. And the programme controller, who eventually got me in for a meeting, sort of said, you know, well, what do you want to achieve by doing work experience here? And I says, well, I want to learn as much as I can, and I'd like to have my own show at some point. And he sort of turned around and said, I can't put someone with an accent like yours on the radio. And so that, in that moment, I was kind of like, don't let him see you're upset. And I was kind of like, I'm going to prove you wrong. And so I think that I've got this, it comes from my mum and dad as well, and the work ethic of growing up in this family run business. You know, it's kind of like, if you work hard for it, you will kind of get there. And so once I kind of allowed myself to be upset, because it's all right to be upset about stuff, and it shows that I care, really. And once I kind of got over that thing and realised that, do you know what, that was their decision. It wasn't my decision. And there are decisions that I can make from this point on. And so it was about working out what I really wanted to do and what I could do. And so it gave me a determination again, I guess, to prove them, not to prove them wrong, but I guess in a way.
To do something more, I mean, because in the back of your mind, maybe you'd had ideas about other things you wanted to do. What was it that you thought is the dream job? It felt to me this year, when you presented the BAFTAs, that might have been
that
one of the things. How do I get to the BAFTAs? This isn't real.
It's taken a long time, but we got there eventually. Yeah, it's funny because there were so many people were so kind and lovely when it was announced I was doing that. And I kind of allowed myself to admit that I deserved it, because I have put the work in. And I think it is about putting those building blocks in place and those relationships and building on them and working on them to get to the point where you're asked to do it. And, you know, it's not like I hadn't been waving in the background.
Without wanting to completely blow smoke up your kind of, you know, what's it? You built the building blocks, you built the foundations, you have the knowledge, the industry respects you, you know, and it's not like you're supplanted because you look good on the cover of a magazine last week. You know, you do look good on the cover of a magazine, but you're there because you are completely and utterly authentic. And that's why it really pleased me, because whoever is the person that gave you the call made a bloody good decision.
God, you're going to make me cry, Gabby.
Well, I know from what you'd have gone through, because you can't help but think at those times, can you, that is this because I'm a mum now? Am I irrelevant? Yeah. You know, do I have any relevance? And so, you know, you're a shining example of how to kind of go, right, let's crack on with these. Let's make these kids actually part of my power.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's even like that first summer after I had Rudy on June the 10th, and I did Glastonbury 10 days later, and after having a C-section. And it was a total reaction to that whole thought process of like, being a mum doesn't make me different. It doesn't change my passions. It doesn't change what I love. It doesn't change the way that I'm going to talk about and love music. Yeah, my priorities will change slightly, but it doesn't change anything about, you know, what I do. And so that was definitely a reaction to try to show people that, I think, as well.
Does your taste, though, change? Relevance is obviously hugely important. You can't kind of like, you know, just because you're busy, you're not able to listen to the bands and go to the gigs and all those things because you're a working mum. Have you found yourself sometimes thinking, oh, that's not for me? Is that not for me because I'm 47? Or is that not for me because it's not very good?
Yeah, but yes and no. There are times where, like, I mean, the kids at the minute are in, they have like, they found a meme playlist on Spotify. And I just like, I'm so bored of the word meme and just the kind of, but then there are some times where I'll play them something. I was playing something the other night and Rudy's like, oh, mum, what's that? And I was like, oh, it's a track called Greyhound by Swedish House Mafia. And he's like, that's amazing. I'm like, oh, I've still got it. You know, that kind of thing that I can still impress a 13-year-old sort of thing with my musical choices. But there are definitely some times where, I mean, we have no control over the you know, the stations that we listen to and stuff.
What do they like then? What are they listening to?
They love Radio 1. Mm-hmm. They love Greg in the morning. And they used to, I'll tell you who they used to really, really love and gutter or laugh at was when Alice Levine and Dev were on, and they just loved them as a duo. But in the car now, they've worked out that they can link up Spotify to the car. And so they have, they just go through these meme songs, and Rudy's really into manga. So there's a load of songs that are around that world that he listens to. But it's, I like how I learn from them in a way as well. Mm-hmm. Like, what's cool?
Yeah. What are people, yeah, it's amazing. Actually, kids are very useful in that respect, yeah, aren't they? If we were working in our business, kind of having that, that touch point, yeah, of going, oh, right, okay. Like, you know, with Mike, it's like, why do you not watch a whole football match? Well, you can watch all this here on my phone. I don't need to, you know, it's that, yeah, kind, yeah, of thing. So,
yeah, 90 minutes is a long time for kids.
Yeah, God, the attention span. Then I think back to my brothers. They didn't at their age. They didn't have phones, but they still didn't watch masses of football. They used to be out in the garden playing it. You mentioned sport and being active. Well, you said you're more into exercise now, self-care, looking after yourself.
Yeah.
Are you really conscious about kind of what you're eating as well and what you're doing with regard to how your body's changing? Have you heard the word perimenopause, for example?
I have heard the word perimenopause. I've got a really lovely consultant who I had my two boys with, and so I go back and see him for my checkups and my various kind of scans and prods and whatnot. And I've got some friends who are going through various stages of, you know, perimenopause, menopause, watch my mum and all that kind of stuff. And so it was obviously in the back of my head. I haven't felt any significant changes to me that warrants me to kind of go, oh, I'm there, or I'm about to, or whatever. But I was conscious about having a conversation with him about it and finding out what I need to look out for, what I should be thinking about. And so after he'd done a scan and checked, it's weird when you think of like someone checking your insides, but you know, it's good to be on that, on top of all that. I said, look, I've just wanted to have a conversation with you about menopause and perimenopause. And his response was amazing. So he turned around to me and went, I've just looked at your ovaries. They're very fruity, so you don't need to worry about it. And I was like, that's the best thing I've ever heard. Not just because you said that, but the way that you said it to me. I was like, your ovaries are very fruity, so you don't need to think about it right now. Genius.
He sounds like he might be an old English chap.
Fruity. Yeah, he's rather posh. But it just makes me feel at ease about all that stuff. He's brilliant.
And what do you think about, I mean, Davina did this very powerful documentary earlier this year, and the conversation does seem to be out there more,
yeah,
which it pleases me, if only because we shouldn't let women of a certain age just disappear from view, you know,
no,
whether it is running big companies, working on TV, presenting the BAFTAs, whatever it is. So has that heartened you as a broadcaster to see that?
Yeah, I think so. I think the whole age conversation and what comes with age is something that needs to be as open and as kind of, I think, kind of encouraged as mental health, really, because I think it's with women in particular that they can work in kind of, you know, against each other almost in a way, and that it can affect your mental health. So I think the fact that we can feel like we can have conversations about it, because I remember growing up and my Aunt Elizabeth having HRT and it was kind of like, oh, shh, kind of thing, you know, no one was sort of, it's like weird, like, why can't you tell me what it is or talk about it or, you know, explain to kind of young women what it is, so that fear factor or that kind of, you know, kind of entering the black hole of menopause is kind of erased, so that it doesn't seem like this terrifying, life-changing experience, so that we can find ways of, you know, because we're all so unique. We've all got such a unique makeup that our response to everything is so unique to our makeup. And I think that it's the build up to it for me personally anyway, is about being more aware of my body, being more aware of myself, what I put into my body, what I do to nourish my body. You know, I just did a 20 minute Peloton because I was like, oh, half one, great, I've got 20 minutes. So I just kind of jumped on the bike. And I really feel now more than ever the benefits of exercise. Mm. So a bit of Peloton, a bit of yoga, been wild swimming, which I love. And I think all that and realizing how it can, how it makes me feel good is kind of the things that I need to be paying attention to more and working.
And when you were younger, like in your 20s, how, because I mean, I imagine it was quite a rock and roll lifestyle. Oh,
yeah, I
imagine there was a lot of partying.
There was a lot of partying,
yeah. A lot of
like late nights and, you know, not much sleep. And I mean, I remember when Colin and I were doing Radio 1 and there'd be, you know, we were on at lunchtime, but we'd still kind of come in and sleep in the office after a night out sort of thing. And it's just like, you wouldn't be allowed to do that anymore. But
And so did you not at that point do much in the way of wild swimming, yoga and, well, the Peloton didn't even exist, did it?
I definitely did a little bit of yoga. I've been doing yoga for a long time. And I used to occasionally, you know, I'd cycle into town sometimes. The only exercise I really did back then was snowboarding, which I started doing when I was 16 and I love it so much. And so that was something that I kind of religiously made sure I did every year. But, you know, that was kind of for a week, 10 days every year. There was a gym membership that never really got used to its full potential. Terry, the personal trainer there, used to, bless him, try and take me around Regent's Park for a run. I mean, it was more of a leisurely stroll, but yeah.
It's interesting that you seem to be a bit of a convert, though, because you obviously realise now just how amazing it makes you feel. Yeah. And mentally, I think, as well. I think it's so important in our 40s.
Absolutely. And I kind of feel that, particularly with, you know, what we've been through with the pandemic and stuff and the restrictions that have been put on our lives and how that kind of weighs on you mentally, I think, as well, you know. And also I was talking to someone about, you know, they were, when we were in the middle of it and saying, oh, how are you coping? I was like, well, I think it's just recognising that you don't know how you're going to feel tomorrow. Like you might wake up in a funk or with a fog and it's almost just recognising that and going, all right, it's going to be one of those days. And just getting through it because, you know, you go to bed and tomorrow's going to be another day. And so that was kind of my approach to it. But I definitely felt that on those foggy days, by doing some kind of exercise, even like a really nice, we just got our first dog in October as well. And so that's
Did you?
And that's been amazing for everybody. Mm. Even just, you know, taking River for a big walk and feeling your heartbeat sort of outside your chest almost. It's so healthy for you.
Just before we can move on, I need to know about the dog.
Oh, but, yeah.
What breed is the dog?
He is a Portuguese water dog.
I love Portuguese water dogs.
He's called River.
For anybody who's wants to picture, it's the Obama dog, basically, isn't it? It's
I kind of call him Mick River because he's got a little kind of, his snout's ginger and he's got this tail that's like a feather duster that's kind of swishes as he kind of walks. It's amazing. Every member of the family has a slightly different relationship with them, which I think is really interesting as well.
And, you know, when you have a dog as well, it's funny, we've had dogs since before we had kids and you can't imagine walking anymore without a dog.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When I go for a walk with a friend that hasn't, well, we haven't got a dog with us, it feels so, I want to get, kind of take somebody else's dog along. I don't know. They just add so much, don't they, to the whole experience. And as we are talking about health right now, it seems like a good time to introduce today's expert, who is Dr. Louise Newson. And she is a leading menopause expert, the founder of the Balance Menopause app, which I thoroughly recommend. And she also has a menopause charity as well, which helps women take control of their hormones and HRT. And Dr. Louise joins us now. Good day to you.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, Louise.
This is Edith. And we've just been chatting actually about Edith's 47. And she's just been told in the most wonderful terms by her doctor specialist that she has fruity ovaries, no signs of, which was a description. Louise is shaking her head.
I loved
it. So she's not having any perimenopause symptoms. But one of the things I want to cut kind of straight into with Edith, particularly in her family history with regard to breast cancer and having the BRCA gene. And obviously a lot of women, especially historically, the way that the kind of news of HRT was presented was this is a no-go area if you have any kind of cancer issues. So much is being demystified about HRT. So can you just kind of talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing to say is HRT is only three letters and it actually stands for hormone replacement therapy, which for most of us who start HRT when we're perimenopausal, it's not replacing anything. It's topping up your missing hormones. You're just reclaiming what you've lost. So it's wrong from so many levels. There are different hormones, there are different types, there are different doses. The most important hormone is estrogen, but also we produce a lot of testosterone, actually more testosterone than estrogen in our bodies. And progesterone is the other hormone. own. We've been told for the last 20 years or so that HRT causes breast cancer. So women have stopped taking it. Healthcare professionals have stopped prescribing it. The media have scared us silly about it. But actually, if you look at the evidence, there isn't any evidence that taking HRT has a statistically significant increased risk of developing breast cancer. And all types of HRT, actually, women who take any type of HRT have a lower risk of dying from breast cancer. Well, the big study in 2002 that scared everyone silly away from HRT was an older type of a synthetic progestogen, actually a type that's in the contraceptive pill that no one seems to worry about. But needless to say, they tried to show there was an increased risk of breast cancer. But when the study was analysed properly, there wasn't a statistically significant increase. It might be a small increased risk, but actually women get breast cancer regardless of taking HRT or not. So it's very hard to tease out whether it was actually caused. It's a bit like saying, oh, Louise, you clean your teeth every morning and now you've got a sore big toe. Cleaning your teeth has caused your sore big toe. It's an association rather than a cause. But now, actually, we prescribe body identical HRT, which is available on the NHS. And the progesterone is this body identical progesterone. So it's the same structure as the hormones we are missing. And the studies have shown there's no increased risk of breast cancer, certainly for the first 5 years. But if you look at the worst study trying to tell us the biggest risk is breast cancer, actually, that small increased risk is less than a risk of breast cancer a woman has if, for example, she drinks a couple of glasses of wine a night, or if she doesn't exercise, or if she's overweight, because they're all risk factors for breast cancer. And so a lot of women are saying, I'm not taking HRT because I understandably don't want breast cancer, but they're actually increasing their risk of breast cancer by their lifestyle. And when women take HRT, they often feel better. It's easier to exercise. They often lose weight, actually. So they're reducing their overall risk. And also they're reducing their risk of heart disease, diabetes, osteoporosis, and dementia. And as women, we're far more likely to die from heart disease and dementia than we are from breast cancer. So it's really important to know the facts. And then this is a very long answer to your question about women who have a family history.
It's a bloody good answer, though, I have to say.
Thanks, Gabby. Yeah. Thank you. So when women have a family history of breast cancer affects one in seven women. So lots of women will have a, you know, an aunt or a granny or a cousin or a sister who's had breast cancer. Some of those women, it will be a small increased risk. Some women will have the BRCA gene and they'll have a quite higher increased risk of developing breast cancer. And some women choose, as you know, to have risk-reducing surgery. Women are sometimes advised to have their ovaries removed because there's a risk of ovarian cancer for some of these women. But actually, as you know, if you remove your ovaries, you are menopausal from the day, you know, the time your ovaries are removed. And a lot of these women are told, no, you can't have HRT. We also know that if a woman has had a hysterectomy and only takes estrogen, then that woman actually has a 25% lower risk of developing breast cancer. And that's following women up for over 20 years. So a long period of time, we know that women have a lower risk of breast cancer. So women might have an increased risk because of their family, but taking HRT isn't going to increase that risk further. And that's what's really important. So there's so many women, I've been doing some charity work, some ovarian cancer charities, lots of young women there who have had their ovaries removed for risk-reducing surgery. They have no hormones and they're absolutely torn apart, not just with their symptoms, but they've got this increased risk of all these diseases that I mentioned. And that risk will increase further because they'll have longer without their hormones.
Wow. So on the one hand, hearing you explain things, I think the more we hear that as a society is so important. On the other hand, I get a little bit angry inside that this has been allowed to kind of this, almost these myths have been allowed to develop into these truths that they're not for so long. And where did it all, you know, come from? Why has it taken so long to get these conversations?
Do you know what? I mean, I'm absolutely furious. And some people who know me know I work really hard, and I'm driven by the stories that I hear every day from women that are suffering. And all these women are trying to do is get their own hormones back. They're not asking for heroin or methadone or, you know, it's just their own hormones. And it's from the WHI study, this Women's Health Initiative study. And I did a podcast talking with one of the investigators, Robert Langer, a few weeks ago that came out. And everyone should listen to that because it's disgusting, actually, what happened. It was $1 billion. So not $1 million, $1 billion study. And it was set up, actually, to look at because everyone was giving HRT left, right and centre, quite rightly, in the 80s and 90s, and decided, well, how, it's so good for younger women, let's give it to older women, let's start it for women in their 60s and see how they get on. But it was a really, really poorly set up study because the average age of starting HRT in these women was 64. We do start HRT in older women, but the type of HRT they were giving was a tablet estrogen, which has a small increased risk of clot, and the older progestogen that I've already said might have a small increased risk of breast cancer, but they also have a small increased risk of clot and heart disease and stroke as well. And so they were given a type of HRT to older women we would never give anyway. And a lot of these women in the study were obese and had heart disease before. A lot of them had had heart attacks. So when they started to give this the HRT, they found some women had heart attacks. So they thought, oh, goodness me, HRT is really bad. And then I think what happened is that they were trying to find a bad result to stop the study because it was so expensive and they weren't getting good results to justify the money. And it's about women. Why would people worry about women? No one does, do they? So they just pulled a plug on it. And what they did is some of the investigators wrote up, said, increased risk of breast cancer, HRT causes breast cancer. And the other investigator said, hang on, it's not shown that. Do not write that up. They said it's too late. It's gone to the New York Herald. It's gone to the one of the medical journals. It's gone to press. We can't do anything about it. And there's an amazing lecture actually on my Menopause Doctor website by Professor Jim Simon. If you just put James Simon into the search, it tells you all the scandal, what's happened. And this Robert Langer said at the time, do not do this because this will be the biggest travesty to women's health ever known. And they said it's too late. And he's right. You know, look at it. One in two women over the age of 50 have osteoporosis. There's women left, right and centre in nursing homes with dementia. I'm not saying that HRT will stop these diseases, but we know from evidence they reduce. And it reduces the risk of a heart attack by 50%, which kills most women. But it's not just about dying. It's about quality of life. You know, I see and speak to thousands of women who have given up their jobs. Their partners have left them. A lot of them, we see extras in the clinic all the time who are suicidal, and they know it's their hormones. So it's just awful, actually. You would never remove a man's testicles and say, let's just see how you get on without your testosterone.
Yeah, there's so many areas you can. I mean, this is, we haven't got time, sadly, to kind of go through every area. But the one that gets me vexed, and it's probably because I'm of the age where, you know, kind of I can see it happening as well, is this idea and this James Timpson article that I read the other day, I know you helped to kind of contribute to, that women just disappear from positions of power and positions of authority. And just when their careers should be really hitting that peak because their kids are a bit older, they've got a little bit more mental kind of headspace, without anything to help them with their hormones for various reasons, whether it's depression or the physical manifestation of hot flushes, you know, or whatever it is, that they decide they have to kind of walk away from potentially incredible careers.
And they do. We know around 20% of people lose their jobs or give up their work or change their work. We did a survey recently of over 3,500 women, and we found that nearly half of them actually wanted to take early retirement and give up work early because of their menopause. But, you know, we're not prepared for it. When I was perimenopausal, I just thought my symptoms were because I was working too hard. I was feeling very tired, very irritable. My memory had gone. My sleep was really poor. You know, one of the reasons we developed the free app Balance is so women can download it and be prepared, have the knowledge, but also do their symptom check every 3 months and then pick it up early. Because there's no doubt about it, I would have given up my job as a doctor if I didn't have hormones feeding my brain, because my brain had gone and I didn't want to go part time. I didn't want to be at home just, you know, not enjoying life. It's, you know, life's too short for that.
And all that training you do and all that knowledge you have and all that wisdom, whatever your career is. Especially as a doctor, though. But, you know, whatever you've done, you've acquired some kind of wisdom in your profession, haven't you?
James's article was great, firstly, because it was written by a man, so it was taken more seriously. And it's true. It's absolutely true. If I'd written it, no one would have read it. But so it's fantastic having his view. But also we need to think about it as a global financial disaster, actually, because women are not, they're not getting their pension, they're not paying into the economy, and they're wasting a lot of money in the health services. We know 40% of NHS staff are menopausal women. So 4 out of 10, and we know how hard the NHS are working. So, I mean, I'm working as an advisor for the NHS with their menopause improvement program, which is going to be pivotal to improving menopause care in the NHS, but it can't come quick enough for these women who are suffering all the time.
Louise, I think the next time I speak to you, I have a feeling hopefully it won't be then, but I feel in the next few years you could be Dame Louise Newson, because what you're doing is so, so important. You're campaigning, the charity work, and, you know, anything personally I can do to help you, I will absolutely, I'm on your kind of parade.
Thanks,
I'm behind you, I'm marching with you. Edith, before Louise goes off and does more to help kind of change history here, anything there that's kind of piqued your interest? Have you?
Yeah, a couple of things actually. Just obviously with my mum was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 50. You know, she sort of went for her happy 50th, have a mammogram. But she was amazed. She went through like 6 weeks of intense radiotherapy. She's brilliant, and she's, you know, touch wood, we were very lucky she got it early. But the one thing that she was really surprised and shocked by when she was chatting with the nurses most days was just about how many women don't go for that mammogram. You know, prevention is, you know, the same way about, you know, talking about the app with menopause, about being there, about and knowing and looking out for the signs, is prevention is half the battle sometimes. And that was something that I was kind of, you know, I was really interested in. But also I'm kind of, you know, I'm stepping closer to 50. And so it's also, it's in the back of my mind, just in terms of, you know, and I get checked every year now anyway. I have done since I had my kids with scans and stuff to check, because, you know, and I haven't had the gene test. Is it something that you would, I know it's breast cancer is not your specialist field, but with it all being kind of tied in and together, is it something that you would recommend?
Well, there's nice guidance about risks of breast cancer and who should we go to genetic screening. So it depends on the number of relatives and how old they were. But it's very easy to just have a look and see whether it's worth being genetically tested. But it's, you know, breast cancer is so common. It used to be 1 in 12 when I was a medical student in the 90s. And now it's, I've said, 1 in 7. And a lot of it is lifestyle. And a lot of it is just bad luck as well. Mm. But we need to think about that. 1 in 7 women have had breast cancer. That means 1 in 7 of those, you know, all those women, so 1 in 7 women who have breast cancer will become menopausal at some stage. And these women are told you can't have hormones, you can't have treatment, that's it, that's your life. And most women who've had breast cancer die from heart disease, not their breast cancer. And I've written a booklet actually that's on my Menopause Doctor website specifically for women who've had breast cancer, because a lot of women have localized symptoms, so vaginal dryness, pain, bladder problems, urinary symptoms. A lot of women I see in the clinic can't sit down because it's so severe, but they've told they can't even have vaginal estrogen, which is incorrect, actually. Women can have vaginal estrogen because it doesn't get absorbed in the body. And some women who've had breast cancer actually choose to take HRT because of the benefits. So, but I've written a really detailed booklet about that, because women who've had breast cancer and are menopausal are just, they fall off a cliff, actually, and they're not looked after properly. And it's a real shame.
Yeah. And then my other quick question as well. So I have a coil, and I've not had the same one in, obviously, since I had Spike, but you know,
good.
But, yeah. But it works for me. It's brilliant. And what's the point where, what happens with that side of things when I start with perimenopause and start stepping into that world?
So yes, if it's a Mirena coil, then it means that you won't be getting periods. So then how do you know when you're perimenopausal or menopausal? Because you haven't got your periods to tell you. The progestogen in the Mirena coil thins the lining of the womb. So actually it's very easy then to take HRT. You just add in some estrogen, either as a patch or gel or spray. So through the skin is safe because there's no risk of clot. And then if women need testosterone as well, they can usually have that as a cream or a gel. So it's about monitoring your symptoms and seeing if there's any change. I mean, I hate to tell you, at age 50, your hormones will not be the same as they were 20 years ago. You can't do a blood test or a saliva test or a urine test or whatever people are sold, because our hormones change all the time. And so they're a complete waste of time and money, actually.
Oh, really? So it's more about your monitoring the symptoms, which
And sometimes it's really hard. There are so many symptoms. You know, there are hundreds of different symptoms because estrogen affects every single cell in our body. And often, you know, are we tired because of life? Are we fed up because of lockdown? Or is it because of our hormones? And sometimes I'll just say to women, do you know what? There are so many health benefits of taking HRT. The earlier you take it, the better for your future health, for your bones, heart, brain, and so forth. So let's try it for 3 months because it's so low risk. And see what happens. And then within 3 months, they go, oh my goodness me, this is the best I felt for ages. And then you've answered your question as to which symptoms are related to the hormones or not.
Yeah, this was me. This was me, Dr. Louise, last year, September last year, where I couldn't work out if I was just, am I just getting old? Yeah. You know, I couldn't. Yeah. And then when I had my levels tested at that point, I was basically told you'll have maybe one more period, which was such a shock to me because I, you know, kind of not a negative shock, but just a shock. I was like, oh my gosh. And it's been pretty much proved to be the case. And so I found it to be absolutely life-changing, and I didn't know I needed life-changing. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I just kind of, it was a slow kind of journey.
My youngest daughter is 10, so I had her when I was 40, and I started HRT 5 years ago, but I wish I'd started it quite soon after I had her. It would have been so much easier to have looked after 3 children with HRT on board.
Oh my God, you have 3 children as well as doing what you're doing. You're amazing.
Yes, amazing. She's incredible. I know.
It's not just me. I work, you know, it's about power with others, isn't it? So I have some really great people who believe in the cause and the charity. Davina McCall has just agreed to be a trustee. So really exciting. We can do some really powerful things with that, hopefully.
Dr. Louise, thank you so much for your time today. I know your time is incredibly valuable, so we really appreciate it. And Edith, I'm sure, appreciates her personal clinic.
Thank you.
She's had with you as well.
So. No worries.
I'll see you later. Take care.
Bye.
Amazing.
Yeah, and hopefully quite useful, not just to you as well, but I think so many women I talk to really have had, I like a lot of things that to do with women's bodies. We just kind of, it's almost like a voyage of discovery as you go along, isn't it? You know, you kind of go, right. So if we're talking about being fit and able and ready and kind of punching through the rest of your career, and you're now at a lovely place, it seems, in terms of doing the kind of projects you want to do, so obviously so well respected in the film world as well as the music world. And I think if my eyesight is that Martin Scorsese behind you on your...
It is. It's Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro.
Right. Okay. So that's how well respected Edith is. They're not in the room, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. No. They're on a picture.
Bob comes around every Wednesday. And just hangs out. Yeah.
Listen. Why not? Do you? I mean, you could do both, as you'd have to choose between film and music. But has film kind of been a lovely kind of add-on almost to the, you know, obviously started out with the music primarily.
Yeah, it was lovely because, you know, I grew up in a little hotel in Scotland where there was just this constant buzz of music around, be that with live bands playing or road shows coming to the hotel or big kind of parties in the car park or whatever it was.
It sounds like an idyllic childhood, by the way.
It was amazing. And my mum playing Nancy and Oliver and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then, but alongside that, my dad set up a little Saturday morning film club for us at the hotel, which was just something for the kids to kind of come and hang out, you know, watching Bugsy Malone or the Goonies and stuff. And so the seed of both these things was very much, you know, from my mum and dad and growing up. And when I was at Radio 1 and Colin and I were doing the show together, and then Colin went off to do Specialist. And I, weirdly, at that point, I kind of was like, oh, well, that's kind of it for me then, you know, because there's always expectation.
Well, the man's gone.
Yeah, that's it. I'm off to do the weather. Not that there's anything wrong with kind of, you know, people doing the weather and stuff, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And so when my boss said, well, no, I want you to do the show. But we need to find what's the thing for the show that we want it to be. And I was like, can it be film, please? And I'd studied film as part of my degree at university. It was just one of the modules. And he was like, yeah. And so myself and my producer at the time, Richard Murdoch, who's now up at BBC Scotland, we really put the work in to kind of go and meet all the film companies and the PRs and just go, look, this is what we want to do. And that's kind of where those relationships started in that world. And now I have my podcast Soundtrack, in which allows me to selfishly indulge in both those worlds and bring them together to talk about, you know, that really special relationship that music and film have together.
I love soundtracks. So when I saw you doing that, I thought that was such a genius. I listen to soundtracks all the time. I love soundtracks.
It's so powerful.
Yes, and evocative, and just and there's so much out there when you start exploring kind of film Amazing. Tracks, and not just the obvious ones that kind of, you know, in our house, because of my husband, he has to play Braveheart quite a lot. I'm only joking. He doesn't. Not anymore. I've stopped it. is it possible for you to tell us at the moment what is the greatest film soundtrack then?
I would say Star Wars, you know, in terms
yes,
of the
yes. my son plays it all the time.
Well, the depth of that whole, you know, when you think of Star Wars, you think of da-da, and you think of the fanfares, but there are so many beautiful kind of delicacies throughout those scores that John Williams created. And I took the kids, actually, before lockdown, we managed two of the films. So we saw A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back at the Royal Albert Hall with the London Symphony Orchestra.
Will they do that again, do you think?
I hope so. And I think that it was really interesting for the kids because I remember Rudy turning around because they had to have an interval in the middle because the musicians play so much.
Yeah.
So he was like, "Mum, there's so much music in it," and I hadn't even realised. And it's true. And that was a lovely way for them to appreciate how much music there is in there. And because it was part of my childhood, you know, growing up and going to the cinema to see stuff that John Williams had done the score for was amazing. Yeah. I stalk his reps every week by sending emails going, "Hi, any chance when the travel gates open, I could come across?" And it would take, you know, I would literally jump on a plane tomorrow.
You'll
COVID
get it. I know you
I'm
will.
Right.
You don't take no for an answer.
One
so
day.
I am absolutely
exactly,
convinced
Gabby.
You will be there. You will be there. Whether he likes it or not, you'll be around his kitchen table with a microphone going, "Let's chat." It feels like you are in such a good place. You've forced the direction of your life in a way that really works for you and suits you. And so thank you so much, Edith, for sparing the time to chat to us and take care of those lovely boys and that gorgeous sounding dog and your husband as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's way down forth. There. It's like children, dogs, husband. Yeah.
Edith, genuinely though, thank you so much. It was really lovely chat.
And pleasure.
Take care, my love. See you soon.
Bye. Lovely.
Well, Edith Bowman is such a breath of fresh air, and whoever told her that her voice was not going to work on radio certainly got that wrong, didn't they? Her podcast is called Soundtracking, and she talks to actors and directors and producers about movie music. It really is excellent if that is your thing. So thank you, Edith, so much for sparing the time to come on. And also a huge thanks to the incredible Dr. Louise Newson, not just for coming on, but for what she is doing for this conversation. Her Balance Menopause app is worth checking out if perhaps you want to start logging your symptoms, or if you know somebody who might be experiencing symptoms, do pass on that information. And her Instagram account is a font of all menopause knowledge too. Thank you to Solgar, who support us on this podcast. They have 300 minerals and vitamins in their range, so there's definitely something for you. Currently, I am crazy busy with work, so I'm topping up on Omnium, which is a great multivitamin. And thank you to Lauren Armstrong-Carter and Rethink Audio for producing. And finally to Elvis, my brother-in-law, for composing and performing our lovely music. And to you for listening. I'll see you next time.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.